you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization. All right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Politics and Science, where we attempt to look at how science, which is used as the basis for major life-impacting decisions in our society, is politically manipulated for profit and power to the detriment of society as a whole. I'm very happy to say that my guest again on Politics and Science is Dr. Rosalie Bertell. Dr. Bertell is a Gray Nun of the Sacred Heart and received her PhD in biometrics with minors in biology and biochemistry from the Catholic University of America. Since that time, she has worked as a biometrician and environmental epidemiologist. By choice, Dr. Bertell works for the victims or potential victims of industrial, technological, and military pollution, with a particular emphasis on assisting the struggles of third world and indigenous people to preserve their human right to life and health. The major issues are the dangers associated with economic globalization, war, and the proliferation of chemical and radioactive pollutants as the result of preparation for war, and the toxic products and processes developed from weapons research and production. And that's exactly what we'll be talking about today. We're going to focus on one of Dr. Bertell's major works, her book, No Immediate Danger, with the subtitle of Prognosis for a Radioactive Earth. It was published by the Women's Press in Toronto in 1985 and is still available today and still as valuable as it was when it was originally published. In a nutshell, No Immediate Danger documents the history of the science and the politics that has led our civilization to the middle of a minefield created by nuclear technology. She concludes the book with a blueprint for extricating our world from this nuclear morass. We and much of our ecosystem are now faced with total destruction, not from the threat of nuclear war alone, but perhaps even more seriously and less well known from the nuclear pollution that inevitably results from nuclear weapons development. Nuclear power is an integral part of this weapons development program. Today, during our time with Dr. Bertell, I'd like to look at how we were led into this predicament, what in sum is the layout of the nuclear minefield we find ourselves in, and how we can begin to wend our way out. Dr. Bertell, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. And can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Good. I think we should just start out very basically and ask you what inspired you to write this rather large and impressive work on the dangers of nuclear technology.
Well, I was a kid at the time of the Second World War, and I was pretty impressed and shocked by Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also by the rocket technology, which the Germans introduced near the end of World War II. And way this nuclear and rocket technology got into our civilian economy was rather amazing to me. I found out later the same thing happened with chlorine chemistry after World War I. But I was especially concerned about nuclear because what it did was introduce into the biosphere radioactive forms of all the chemicals central to the chemical chart. All these atoms could now appear in radioactive form. And if you understand that our world, all our living beings are made of these chemicals that form molecules and proteins and living tissue. And then you think somebody is creating a toxic form of the atom itself. That just really blew my mind. I couldn't understand attacking the very foundation of life itself.
So just to make that perfectly clear, you're saying that the elements that
were
made out of atoms and were made out of all these basic elements, and that the effort to build nuclear weapons basically led to creating radioactive forms of all those basic elements that were made out of, toxic forms of those elements.
For example, we always had iodine. It's very important to the functioning of the thyroid gland. Mm-hmm. But now we had radioactive iodine. And the body needs iron and other trace metals. Now we have radioactive iron and so on. So all of these very basic human needs and needs of all living creatures were now, these. Once you put these things into a recycling earth, they're going to show up in living tissue the same as every other atom is recycled on our planet.
Hmm.
So it was scary to me to think anybody would do such a really dangerous and crazy thing.
We've covered this before when you were on, but I don't think you can say it too much. And many people arguing in favor of nuclear technology and power say that the leakage from nuclear power plants is no different than background radiation that the Earth has always had. And so you're saying that these are brand new chemicals.
They are. Well, they're not new chemicals. They're atoms. They were atoms here before, but they're being created in isotopes that are radioactive, whereas the radioactive form of that atom didn't exist before.
Okay.
People are mostly worried about toxic chemicals, but chemicals are made of atoms, and if you create a radioactive form of the atom, that atom will eventually get into all the chemicals.
Mm.
So you're going to have not only toxic chemicals, but chemicals that are both radioactive and toxic. It takes a time for these things to recycle into the biosphere, but there's absolutely no reason to think they won't with time, and we're leaving this for future generations.
So you realized this as a child? You were a scientist as a child, it sounds like?
Well, I guess I realized it through my mother and father. We didn't, in our house, we didn't celebrate at the end of World War II. And I remember my mother just saying over and over again, they shouldn't have done it, they shouldn't have done it. And I don't know how she understood what these atomic bombs were, but she had some kind of sense that this was not right, whatever closed that war, and I understand that it saved lives in a certain sense. It also killed a lot of women and children and elderly, but it introduced a state of perpetual war, and it introduced a new toxin in that atoms could be made dangerous for humans and all life. And that's an incredible thing to have happened.
Mm. Explain how it became a state of perpetual war. The nuclear technology created that, you're saying.
Yes, I believe it did, because there was fear that since we dropped it on population, there was fear of retaliation. And the military started as early as 1946 setting off nuclear bombs in the Pacific. in the Bikini Atoll. In fact, they took all old warships that they were not going to use, and they put them in the Bikini Atoll and dropped nuclear bombs on them. And they had the intention of then sailing across the Pacific and into San Francisco Harbor with these battleships to show that they could survive a nuclear war. And this would hopefully deter anybody from attacking the United States. But it didn't work out that way. They actually had to sink most of the ships and destroy them because they were so radioactive. And they even sent in military to try to scrub them clean or get the radioactivity out of the material of the ship. They couldn't do it. So, you know, they knew this from 1946, and they started gearing up to change our whole military ordnance to nuclear after the 1954 hydrogen bomb that they set off in the Pacific. So, this was what was the arms race.
Mm-hmm.
So we never had a peacetime after World War II. They geared up for war immediately.
I see. In your book, No Immediate Danger, you talk about how all of this is preparations for the Third World War, which is yet to take place. So I guess that's what you're referring to.
Well, there was never a peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
After World War II, there was always, we stayed mobilized for war, and we even increased the mobilization because we feared retaliation after dropping the A-bomb. Russia had it by 1949, and it went on from there. But, we stayed with wartime-type production. After World War II, it didn't stop.
Now, you're saying there's an immense danger from the radioactivity of these elements and chemicals, and it sounds like they were aware of that, in that they couldn't scrub those ships clean in the Bikini Atoll after dropping.
Yes, they knew it,
mm-hmm.
And the Nobel Prize was given in 1944, to show the genetic effects of radiation. So this was a Nobel Prize. It wasn't, some kind of hidden esoteric scientific work.
Hmm.
It was very public. So they knew these things. Radiation had caused cancer since 1920. So this was the big problem with the radiation dial painters was in the 1920s and 30s. So this was not an unknown problem.
Mm.
What really, people have been given a pretty false story on this. Most people are thinking that they learned about radiation by studying the atomic bomb survivors. In fact, I've had professionals tell me that our radiation protection standards are based on the studies at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's really blatantly untrue because the radiation protection standards were first proposed internationally in 1950. That was only 5 years after the bomb. They collected the names for the long-term study in the census of 1950 in Japan. So they had not even collected the names or entered them into computer or done anything to design the study by 1950, which is when they set the standards.
Hmm.
The U.S. is still using the general 5 rad exposure to the workers and 0.5 rad for the general public, which was what was set in 1950.
Wow. Yeah, I think
now, they made some modifications of it, you know, here and there for body parts and some things they've made a higher exposure because they can't control the nuclear process. But, you know, generally, everything was set by 1950.
And I think you mentioned this in the last show, that the standards weren't set by health people. They're set by nuclear physicists.
They were set by the physicists who had brought us the Manhattan Project. So it's a kind of renegade science, as far as I'm concerned. And I think the thing that really upset me the most is that the regulation was set, and then they never tested it later to see if it was correct. There's no really good studies. There's a few coming out now, but it's 60 years too late that they're coming out with their studies. So even the way it was based on ionization and the way it was, that was about the same time as we learned about DNA. So they really had a theory that the radiation ionization was the cause of cancer. But they blamed it on ionization. Since the 1990s, that has been in kind of disrepute because it won't explain new science on the bystander effect or the genomic instability. So there are discoveries we've made in the last 60 years in biochemistry and biophysics that don't jibe with the theory they had back in the 1950s. So, and they still haven't really admitted that there's a problem.
The bystander effect, I've heard of that before.
Well, that's where you deliberately expose some living tissue to radiation, and the cancer occurs not in the cells that were irradiated, but cells nearby that were not irradiated. Now, that's a little hard to explain. If your theory is kind of a image of a target that you have to hit the cell and break the DNA and that causes a cancer, because the cancer is caused in another cell that you didn't hit. So, you know, you kind of, you're in left field as far as your science is concerned.
Yeah.
When that happens.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, they set those standards without data originally.
Right. They had some idea. Prior to 1950, they set radiation standards on the basis of skin burns. Mm. And so if they didn't see the skin burn, they thought nothing had happened. At least by the time they did the atomic bomb detonation, they knew that there were effects below the level at which you burn the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was like the only thing going for them, is that they had admitted that much.
I see. The name of your book, No Immediate Danger, does that relate to these inadequate standards?
Well, that's the standard public relations statement. In fact, I was amazed later at Three Mile Island, that's exactly what they said on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
No immediate danger. There was a radiation or a bubble and a burst of the fuel rods at Three Mile Island, but there's no immediate danger.
So that's
however, they did evacuate the pregnant women and children.
But
that's a standard phrase that's used. It's in the book that they use to communicate with the public when there's a radiation leak.
There's a book?
Yes, there's a handbook that they're supposed to use when they talk to the general public. And that's the phrase, there's no immediate danger.
I see. I wanted to ask you about the context of the politics of nuclear science. It sounds like the title, There No Immediate Danger, refers to the regulatory agencies. And one of the things that interested me was you mentioned Three Mile Island and that the public relations for that catastrophe by the industry was handled by the National Security Council, which I thought was curious because I would have thought it would be handled by the nuclear company who owned the reactor or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Well, if you really stop to think about it, what people really cared about was their health. And so it was national security to protect the nuclear weapon industry. Therefore, you had to make tight control of anything that was said about health.
Because if people got upset, then it would threaten the longevity of the nuclear weapons industry?
Correct. Who's going to handle the stuff? And you have to run a reactor to get the plutonium, for example. So the nuclear weapons industry uses uranium mining and milling and fabrication. They run reactors. They do the reprocessing and handle all the radioactive materials, and they release it to the atmosphere the same as the commercial industry. So you're not going to get people to do that. If you have this accident, you get a lot of people discussing what happened to their health as a result of it. Mm-hmm. So they kept a lid on it. I was on a citizen advisory committee to that Blue Ribbon panel that was set up by President Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And as probably people know, he was a nuclear physicist himself. And he had been overexposed at an accident that happened in Canada, and he had his lifetime dose of radiation according to their standards. So he was very well protected when he was whisked into the Three Mile Island plant with complete radiation protection garments on and taken into the control room for a news media and then whisked out again and back to Washington. Many of the people that were at the plant that were writing for the newspapers or talking for the radio programs or TV contacted me afterwards because they had been standing out in the open near that failed reactor. And when they saw the president come and whisked in and in complete safety garb, they were pretty upset.
Hmm. I can imagine.
Anyway, that panel was set up by President Carter, and it was set up in such a way that Dr. Kemeny was the chairperson, and he had been on the Manhattan Project. Everybody else on that Blue Ribbon panel was a member of the public, and they, belonged to colleges or academia, and they were public figures. But they did not have science background for the most part, and they did not have security clearance. Now, the people that were providing them with all the data were the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff and the Department of Energy staff. Both of those staffs have security clearance. Therefore, anything that they wanted to control, they could make a security secret And it could be, it could go to the staff, but it could not go to the Blue Ribbon panel because they didn't have security clearance. Only Dr. Kemeny had it, to my knowledge. Anyway, this is what we brought up at the, they had a one meeting in Washington where they flew people from all over the country to be in the Citizen Advisory Committee. And we only asked two questions. I asked, what about the security clearance of the Blue Ribbon panel? And they wouldn't answer. And someone else asked, who was in charge during the accident? And they wouldn't answer that. And then they just told us all to go home. And they dissolved the panel. We found out later that they had only appointed us because they wanted us to give suggestions for how the nuclear commercial industry could save face or increase its public relations after this accident, which was really not on our minds to give.
Oh, you, in the book you said that the nuclear energy is rooted in war, oppression, and secrecy, and manipulation, and the rule of the fist, as you say. And is this an example of that, basically?
Yes, they had to keep they had to keep the information hidden from people, because otherwise their whole weapon industry was jeopardized. Who was going to work in that industry? Who was going to be at the Nevada test site? Who was going to dig the tunnels for them? Who was going to put up with the debris that was coming from fallout? So you had a lot at stake. That's why it was under national security. But I don't want to give the impression that nuclear commercial industry needs the weapon industry. It only goes one direction. The weapons industry needs the commercial industry. So you could work in the commercial industry. You could follow these nuclear protection regulations, and you thought you had a good industry, and you didn't have any love for weapons, nor were you trying to help the weapons industry. So if that was a good commercial industry, it could have gone with all the subsidy it had and all the research that was handed to them and everything else, but it really fell apart by its own weight. But the weapons industry cannot survive without a commercial front, because you have to have the universities teaching nuclear physics and nuclear engineering, and if the only job opportunity was in weapons, I don't think any of your major universities would offer a course. In the same way, how are you going to get miners to mine uranium or millers to do the milling, and who's going to do the fabrication of the fuel rods if the only way they're going to be used is to make weapons? You can't run an industry that's totally weapons, because who are you going to get to cooperate with it, especially when it leaves a mess at every stage of the game?
So I guess in your mind, this is why the government provides such massive subsidies to nuclear power.
Of course. They had to have a front. And that didn't mean that the people in the front industry were deliberately helping the weapons. They didn't even have to know. They just were running a commercial industry and feeling good about it.
I see. Well, we've talked some about the massive pollution that was caused by the above-ground nuclear testing, which is still in our environment and still being recycled.
In our bodies.
It's horrifying to think about it. But we haven't talked about the good side, supposedly, of nuclear industry, which is nuclear power.
Well, it's a rather esoteric way to boil water. The technology is not new. The technology is the same as the steam engine. So they boil water, make steam, and it turns a turbine. It makes the electricity. So it's not a mysterious new technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the fuel is so dangerous and so liable to cause major disasters that everything is designed to protect the fuel. And there are other ways to boil water.
Yeah, ways that don't necessarily threaten the earth. For how long is the are the contaminants around after they've been used?
Well, you're talking into hundreds of thousands of years. You know, some of the plutonium and the uranium will be around forever, basically. You know, you're dealing with when I think of some simple ways to boil water, I'm thinking of being in France, and I visited this man who had made a lens, a hollow lens, which out of blown glass. It was quite an achievement, but he put wine in it, white wine,
mm-hmm.
and he used it to focus the rays of the sun, and he actually produced heat enough to use as a kiln he could use it as an oven for his clay.
Wow.
Which is much higher temperature than you need to boil water. And, you know, like, that's pretty simple technology to boil water. You really don't need to use this kind of fuel.
Mm-hmm. And nuclear power is basically producing the same poisonous chemicals that the bomb testing did.
Yes, it's the same thing. They try to encapsulate it in the fuel rods. The current proposal for nuclear power, though, would require reprocessing, which says you take those fuel rods, which are at least containing some of the radionuclides produced, in this fissioning, and they use acid to dissolve the cladding and set all those radioactive chemicals free, and then they chemically separate out the plutonium and uranium to reuse, and this is a part of what they're proposing in terms of new nuclear power plants. And reprocessing is a part of their cycle. So then you have the radioactive waste that there's no place to put.
And it's they bill it as something that's going to reduce radioactive waste. Is that not true?
Well, if you don't call it waste, if you chemically separate out what you want to use, and then you call the rest a reduced waste. But, you know, when you use this recycled fuel, it has all the... It's not perfectly separated out. So it's got all the other radionuclides in it, and they will all be released in the process.
Hmm.
And you turn out even more radioactive waste. So it's... It's a myth that you're going to reduce the waste.
I see. Is that you speak in the book of strategic misrepresentations? And just a minute, I should say that we're talking to Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who's a doctor of biometrics with minors in biology and biochemistry, and she's an expert on the physiological effects of low-level radiation. And we're talking about her book, No Immediate Danger. And Dr. Bertel, you... mentioned in the book that industry and government uses what are called strategic misrepresentations. And is that what's going on now when they're trying to tell the North American continent, basically, that we should be emulating France's reprocessing of nuclear waste and basically France's entire nuclear technology?
Yeah, there's a lot of myth in it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, any gas produced, radioactive gas or any radioactive liquid produced, and some of the particulates they release directly to air or water, and so they don't call it waste. The only thing they call waste are the solids that are produced. Now, you're producing all of these radioactive chemicals, but you're not calling it waste unless it happens to be a solid. Because at that high temperature, some of it's going to be gaseous, some liquid, and some solid. So that's, you know, that's deceptive.
I see. That is deceptive.
There are all kinds of things deceptive. It's not cheap. It's not clean. They define clean as meaning not emitting carbon dioxide. But that doesn't make it clean. It just makes it not adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. It does release a lot of radioactive particles that emit beta radiation. Beta radiation will react with nitrogen and oxygen in the air and produce nitric acid. And there are many other things that are radioactive gases, radioactive liquids, particulates that are released. The particulates are nanoparticles, which you can breathe, which can go right from the nasal passages to the brain. So, you know, this stuff is not breakfast food, and they sell it in the same manner as they would sell breakfast food.
Mm. You have an example in your book entitled The 4-Foot Cube. It's a advertising campaign by the nuclear power industry saying that all the waste left from a year's supply of nuclear-generated energy could reside in a 4-foot cube. Can you decipher that for us?
Well, yeah, it would cause fissioning because you can't push it that close together. you know, it's they had a lot of these gimmicks. They've really stopped using that one. Right now it's just clean, cheap, and something else, three things they call it. But they're all deceptive, and, you know, they make their own definition of clean, their own definition of cheap, and whatever the other thing is that is the latest public relations approach. But the ordinary person uses those words to mean it won't hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't ruin the economy, and it won't take the money away from solar power and wind power. You know, so you're doing that in your own mind. It's they say something about solar power. We can't use it at night, and we need electricity at night. So they make you think you're not going to have any electricity if you use solar power. We do have batteries, and batteries work during the night when there's no sun, mm-hmm. and when there's no wind, you can also use a battery. So they're very deceptive ads.
Yeah.
I don't blame people for being confused. They're being deliberately confused.
And another strategic misrepresentation you talked about is sometimes when reactors release gases, they say it's all right because they just release noble gases. And can you explain that?
Well, a noble gas is one which doesn't chemically react with other chemicals. But that doesn't make it not radioactive. So it can still cause skin cancer. It can still be breathed into your lungs and give a dose to the tissue. So it's just because it's chemically inert doesn't mean it's radiologically inert.
Mm. So it's still putting the public at risk.
It puts the public at risk, and it's deceptive. It's not, you can't take them to court for lying. Because it is an inert gas, but it's only chemically inert. It's not radiologically inert.
I see. So let's talk a little bit about how they set these standards that allow them to leak, consistently leak these dangerous radiological chemicals into our environment. You talk in the book about permissible damage. regulating authorities basically decide what is permissible damage, and maybe you can address how they do that.
Well, yeah, that brings up the whole question of regulation. Unless you understand who makes them, made the regulation and what it was based on, you don't know what the regulation means. So regulations for radiation exposure are what's called risk-benefit trade-offs. It's, well, it's even accepted by the U.S. National Academy of Science that no exposure to radiation is without risk. So the risk goes right down to zero. And anything above zero that's unnecessary or man-made or whatever you want to call it is adding to your risk. So when you're dealing with something like that, you make a trade-off. You say, well, what is the benefit and how much damage in the population would be acceptable? Now, acceptable to whom? It means acceptable to the people that are handling the radiation. They think it's okay for the population to suffer certain sicknesses, including cancer and birth defects. So they make a trade-off based on the cost of reducing the emissions and, the cost of cancer or the cost of a stillbirth or a birth defect in a child. So they make these trade-offs for us and then recommend this risk-benefit trade-off as the radiation protection standard, which allows the industry to go ahead and make weapons and run reactors and also use it for nuclear medicine. They don't regulate nuclear medicine at all. That's unregulated. But the workers in a hospital, for example, they follow the same regulations as nuclear workers or weapons handlers.
So there's no public health finding on what should be used for therapy?
No, so you can understand if you look at the three uses, the main uses are medical, civil, electricity, and weapons.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the benefit? It's not medicine.
Hmm.
The benefit is the nuclear weapons industry.
I see. And so it seems unbelievable to me that people are making decisions that allow so many birth defects per thousand and so many lung cancers per thousand, and they're saying there's a risk-benefit associated with this, that even though some people are having stillbirths and getting cancer, that it's worth it in order to have nuclear power. Isn't this the same as any other industry that has a risk benefit? What's the difference with nuclear power?
Well, in a chemical where there's no safety limit, where it's going to be harmful, they have the custom in occupational health to say it's a safe industry if there's no more than one death per year per 10,000 workers.
Mm-hmm.
And no more than one death in a million, or some of them in 100,000 people per year. The nuclear regulations that would permit about 50 people per million per year to get cancer, for example.
How many? Excuse me. How many, Dr. Bertel? How many people? With the
50.
50
people. And this is
okay.
According to their calculations.
I see.
But what is even more disturbing is that our judges and our lawyers come from the general public, and they look at the radiation regulations as if they were safe. And so if someone has cancer and has worked in a nuclear plant, they're supposed to prove that they were overexposed, that they were exposed above the safety limit. And it's actually a whole thing is a myth, because they permit people to get cancer and within the regulation, but it's not understood that way by a court. So it's and our soldiers have to prove that they're overexposed, and of course the military keeps all the records. Mm. So it's a very difficult thing for the atomic veterans. For example, there's a group of young men in the Navy that were stationed in the Antarctic, where the U.S. tried to run a nuclear power plant, which eventually failed, but they put the plant on the side of a hill and the base for the men at the foot of the hill. So their water supply was exposed, and they got the fallout from the airborne effluents. And so many of them are sick. Mm. But they're supposed to prove now that they were overexposed at the time when they were, you know, 17 or 18 years old.
Mm.
And then the Navy has all the records.
I see. The Navy is not assisting them.
Well, they're not really helping. No.
Yeah, right. I see.
And, you know, what do you do when you followed all the rules and regulations, but you still got sick? And then when you try to get compensation, you're told you were never overexposed, so therefore it's not due to radiation.
Well,
if it's something you can see right away, for example, let's say you're building a bridge and someone falls off the bridge, that's very obvious. Connecting the accident at work.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get radiation exposure and you don't get sick for 10 years or 20 years, there's no obvious connection between the illness and the radiation exposure. So the person either has to run a large, expensive epidemiological study of all workers to show that there's a measurable excess of radiation-related cancer, or they have to prove that they were overexposed, and maybe they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So, the victims are not recognized or compensated.
Yeah, that sounds like a terrible predicament. What we only have about 10 minutes left. This has flown by, and we're talking to Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who's an expert in the physiological effects of low-level radiation. And there's so many other things to talk about, but I thought perhaps we should talk about how to get the word out, because if what you're saying is true, then society would reject nuclear power and nuclear weapons if they knew the human and environmental toll that the pollutants are taking on the Earth. How do we get the word out to them? Are there any other dissident scientists or scientists who are interested in finding out the truth about this? Besides yourself at this time?
Yes, there are. There are quite a few. Some are now deceased. They worked their whole life to try to expose this.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't think that the goal is just to get rid of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. I think it's to get rid of war. And it seems to me that given the global communication and ability to travel now, and even the widespread use of English, we could at least solve most international conflicts in a courtroom. And I really think that the United Nations and the World Court are our best bet for moving into the future. Right now, we're overspending what the Earth can replenish, and one of the biggest spenders is the military, and this is the military in all countries, but we're probably the the most reckless user of the environment. But right now we're running between 30% and 40% resource devouring, more than the earth can replenish. So we're stealing from future generations. So the only sector of society that we could really do without is the military sector. But the trick is you have to do it in all the countries in the whole world at the same time.
Mm.
So I made a proposal in my book that you could do this. We have very good records on how much military production and trade goes on every year in every country in the world, and this is all published. So I would just propose freezing it at the current level, and then next time reducing everybody's military budget, because they need the money to do all this, reduce the budget by 20%, or some other percent if you want to, but I would do it in 5 years with 20% reductions.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'd find that the research would go first, then the higher paid military leaders would probably go, and the younger recruits could be moved into a UN peacekeeping force or a military that would aid people in natural calamities, you know, that would be available for tsunamis or floods or fires or whatever else might occur. This would, and you have to at the same time strengthen the courts to handle disputes. But the way to do this, I think, is to take that 20% reduction and have people turn that amount of money into the UN and receive UN currency in return that can be used for education or health or social services. And in that way, you would be building up an international currency at the same time as you were strengthening the civilian economy, and you're reducing the military economies all at the same time.
Hmm.
So we could do this, and we could do it safely, and we could do it with open monitoring, since we already have that. That's in place.
Mm-hmm.
And if the international court was strengthened at the same time, and there's now a lot of international laws that every country has signed in on, you know, we could actually use this system. For example, when 9/11 occurred, we do have an international police force, the Interpol, and the U.S. was actually taking its turn as being the head of Interpol. One of Interpol's mandates is to deal with international terrorist attacks. And so we could have gone to Interpol and had them take the lead in trying to identify the terrorists that caused 9/11. And if we had evidence, we could have introduced it to the criminal court. So, you know, we're not using the systems that are available to us. We don't even know about them. Most people are not even aware that there is an international police force, that 180 countries belong to it, and that it has a brand new state-of-the-art building in Lyon, France.
Hmm.
And, you know, they don't even know these things exist. So we're not well informed on the international level.
Mm.
We're not really aware of the good things the United Nations is doing. We only know when there's a problem.
Now, I think we're all wrapped up in our own nationalities, and basically our national media reinforces that. So we don't think
That's right.
internationally. And I did like your economic plan there, of sort of an economic version of beating swords into plowshares through the UN. I think that's
yes, it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
It takes some imagination and some will, but I think people are so upset at what's happening to the earth, the depletion of resources, the climate change, the acidification of the oceans, the disappearance of so many species. You know, these things, this is our home. This is where we live. This is where we bring up our children. And it should be a safe place. And it's never going to be a safe place with all these weapons.
Is there any final words to our audience here? We're talking to Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who's a doctor of biometrics and an expert on the physiological effects of low-level radiation. Any final words, Dr. Bertel?
I guess I would like to tell people, too, that they can understand these things, and they do have a responsibility, and if they take charge, they'll be glad. It was amazing what happened this year with the election of President Obama. I hope he doesn't disappoint us, but it showed what people could do when they work together. And I think we could do this one. We don't have to wreck our planet and ourselves and our future, but we have to take charge, and we have to find out things, and we have to use our imaginations, and we have to change our mind patterns and discard all these myths that we're relying on. And tell the truth to one another. Don't wait till you retire to tell the truth.
That sounds like a recipe for a much better planet.
Well, we should be able to live on this beautiful planet that God gave us.
You say that life is too precious to leave to the politicians and scientists, but I think I'm willing to leave it to you.
Well, I don't know. I'm on my way out, but there are other people like me, and the future can be bright, but it's got to be a population that wakes up to the beauty they're losing, wakes up to the livability of the planet that's being destroyed, and we've got to care about the whole Earth, not just our corner.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, for being on Politics and Science tonight. And I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, good night.
Night.
That was Dr. Rosalie Bertel, doctor of biometrics with minors in biology and biochemistry. She's an expert on the physiological effects of low-level radiation. She has a very long resume, and you can find out more about her by going to IICPH.org. That's the International Institute of Concern for Public Health, which she founded, the IICPH.org. There's more information about this subject also found at radiation.org. Thank you for listening. This is John Barkhausen signing off for Politics and Science. If you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.